Welcome to Photo Geek Weekly, episode 42. We're recording this on October 18th, 2018. And some interesting news this week, actually, on the software side of stuff. Cutting edge technology that might affect the way our electronics are designed, at least the way we understand the nature of light itself, and all sorts of ins and outs of the industry. And with me today to discuss all of these wonderful topics is a repeat guest, Alan Attridge. Thanks so much for being back on, Alan.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Don.
Yeah, so we had a big announcement from Adobe come down, and I've updated pretty much all of the applications that they provide to various different degrees. And there is some interesting features that they've added and improved within some of their software. I didn't look at it at first. I just started using Photoshop. And so it was kind of, frustrating for me because they've changed some fundamental stuff within the application that if you are kind of used to muscle memory keyboard shortcuts and just kind of zoning out and letting your fingers kind of do the work, then you're going to be, kind of slapped in the face by some of these changes. In the end, I think it's going to be good, but I don't know if it's, maybe I'm just kind of a curmudgeon and I just don't want things to change.
Are you talking about the undo button?
Well, that's one of them, actually. Yeah. So normally Control Z would send you back one step. And if you press it again, it would send you forward one step. In other Adobe applications, like Illustrator, for example, Control Z would send you back a step, and pressing it again would send you back another step. And I think that was consistent amongst most of the other programs as well. In Photoshop, you would have to press Control Alt Z. I'm on a PC. The Mac keyboard shortcuts are going to be different, but you'd have to do a three-finger keyboard shortcut to go back multiple steps and keep on going back. And I think it was Control-Shift-Z to go forward again. They've simplified that. So now it's Control-Z will send you back as many steps as you want to go. And if you want the kind of back and forth, they've just reversed them. So now Control-Alt-Z would send you just that back and forward kind of behavior. And that's driving me nuts. And yes, I'm going to get used to it. But I mean, it's so ingrained in the way that they've been doing it that way forever, I'm assuming, at least as long as I've been using Photoshop. And so my learned behavior has to be unlearned. And there was another one too that was I didn't even have to read up on this one. But when you're trying to use the transform tool, and normally you'd hold down the shift key, which would constrain the proportions so that you wouldn't be making, say, a person skinny or fat or whatever it is. Now, you don't have to press anything and the proportions are already constrained.
Unless you hold them.
When you hold the shift key down, it's no longer constraining proportions. And I was having an old man moment. It's like, this is not how it's supposed to behave. I'm not doing anything different, but things are not cooperating. I don't understand. That was a point of frustration as well. There's lots of other stuff here to talk about, though. Did anything jump out at you?
I was very happy about the undo. Unlike yourself, I've used old versions of Photoshop that lasted me for a long time until I needed to upgrade, which I just recently did, a year ago or something like that. So for a long time, I was doing the, for me, Apple Z, Command Z, back. That's all it was. And that is consistent across Final Cut Pro, anything else I was using. So my first day with the new Photoshop a year ago was very frustrating. So that one, as odd as it sounds, they must have gotten some feedback from old men, true old men, and gone back to it. So I was happy about that one. And the rest of Photoshop, there's a few things that stuck out, actually. Things that might seem innocuous, but I won't use all of the features, but there's a couple.
Well, nobody does. I mean, Photoshop is designed for graphic designers as well as it is for photographers.
Was it always that way? Or because there is Illustrator.
Of course, yeah. And I mean, Photoshop has video editing capabilities and 3D modeling capabilities too. I mean, it is a multifaceted piece of software.
So that was my takeaway from this big announcement. There's a lot of individual things, but it felt to me like Adobe's taking another step into merging a lot of the apps and basically having so much crossover that, you know, do you need to have the whole suite? Maybe they're going to go away from the suite and just kind of have, you know, a one program for everything. But the one thing in Photoshop that really struck me was the frame tool, I guess they're calling it.
Yeah, so this is a functionality that's very similar to what you would get from InDesign, where you would create like a frame object, and then you can, you know, put an asset in there, whether it be an image or a graphic, whatever it happens to be. And that same functionality at its core is now built right into Photoshop.
Right. That kind of surprised me.
Yeah, because I mean, I would use InDesign, of course, to I did it to create my Sky Crystals book. And I don't think this frame tool in Photoshop is going to be a substitute for that. But if I was going to be doing like a simple one page design or a billboard or whatever it happens to be, and I'm using Photoshop, I can use it as a more effective design tool. The problem with this new frame tool, though, is they, of course, had to add an icon to it on the menu bar on the side.
Right.
Now, the way I operate Photoshop is I can click and there's a little, a very small double-sided or an arrow at the very, very top of the menu. And if you click this double arrow, it spits the or splits rather the menu into two columns. And it's just the way that I've always used it. It's the way that I'm comfortable using it. But because they've added this frame tool, it's offset the location of every other tool in this in this column. So all of the tools that I have remembered to be on the left side, they're now on the right side, and vice versa.
Oh,
and so yeah, it's driving me nuts. If the brush tool was always on the right side, now it's on the left side. You know, the
can you drag that tool to the bottom? Can you drag the new one, the frame tool? Can you drag it to the bottom?
I could probably customize this menu in some way, mm-hmm. but I like to use Photoshop in a vanilla kind of construct, because if I'm teaching people, I need to remember what the base, you know, static out of the box configuration is and work with that readily. So, yeah, there's a couple of frustrations there.
That's interesting. Yeah, I've had that situation where I'm trying to explain something to somebody over, you know, via telephone or whatever it is. I'm just kidding. Nobody talks on the telephone anymore. I'm sure it was an app, but I didn't want to advertise for one app. But and I'm trying to explain to them, hey, you know, okay, go click up, you know, up the left hand corner. Do you see this icon? So you're right. You have to know exactly where it is in its base form, if you're going to help anybody.
Exactly. So a few other things to talk on for Photoshop. You can now double click to edit text. That's helpful and convenient.
That is wildly fast.
Yeah, and lorem ipsum placeholder text. If you, you know, drag a text box around, then you know it will be automatically filled with just placeholder text. Or if you start writing something, there's words already there, so that if you're trying to figure out the size of the font or the type of the font, you don't have to provide it content to begin with. Again, a bit of a time saver. There's a blend mode preview.
That one really caught my eye. That one caught my eye.
Well, you know, it caught your eye because you're on a Mac. It doesn't matter for me on a PC, because for me, blending modes are a drop-down list. And I can just use the up and down arrows on my keyboard to get a preview of them automatically without having to click on anyone individually. But on a Mac, you in the past, you would have had to have clicked on them specifically to see the effect. Now you're mimicking behavior that Windows has had for years.
All right. it's welcome to me. Because I'm, you know, so for me, Photoshop is not my go-to program. I mean, it is for photo editing, but in the entire suite, I'm a video guy. That's what I do. And
we're going to get to Premiere later, because I want to get your comments on that. The new Premiere Rush, which I think is a really interesting prospect. But I want to finish off on here. There's some performance improvements and some dialogue boxes that don't need to be there, won't show up anymore, et cetera, et cetera. Onward and upward. The big feature in this new update is improvements to the Content Aware Fill tool.
Right.
And This, I think, has been sorely needed because content-aware fill was sometimes a perfect magic bullet and sometimes it just vomited all over the image because it was sampling from stuff from an area that it shouldn't have and it was sampling them sort of in exactly the same orientation. It wasn't necessarily rotating or changing things to make it fit a little bit better.
Mm-hmm.
So now under the edit menu, there is a content-aware fill button that will bring up its own separate screen, its own interface, that will allow you specifically to paint off areas that you don't want to have included in its fill operation. And it will allow you to control more precisely the color grading, the ability of rotating things and scale and mirror and all of this type of stuff. So it is now much more powerful so long as you give a little bit of extra attention to its behavior. And if I can spend, I don't know, 30 seconds training it for one particular thing, it will save me possibly 5 or 10 minutes of manually cloning in that area. So I think that's a huge help, especially for people that might not have extensive skills in cloning and healing an image. This is a way for them to step up to the plate and hit it out of the park without a whole lot of effort.
I'm looking forward to this one the most, actually, because I've never actually used it, even in its earliest forms, which is kind of what previous version was. I kind of messed around with it, was not impressed. I guess I hit the vomit setting that you talked about and thought, okay, it's great, but it's fine, but I can do a better job.
And sometimes I would use it just as a starting point,
right,
and then I would start to heal over top of it with the healing and the cloning tools myself, just to improve what Photoshop had created. And I've seen some video demos of this, and it is night and day, so long as you control things properly on your end.
Mm-hmm. So I look forward to that. There's one other thing that I really caught my eye, what fits in nicely, it's kind of a geek thing, is the new distribute button.
Yeah, that was pretty cool too. Again, it's more of a graphic design feature, but I can see myself using this for printing because if I'm printing, it's usually going to be on a 24 or 44 inch roll of paper.
Mm-hmm.
And for smaller prints, I will separate, I'll put them all into the same Photoshop workspace and I will manually separate them to be roughly equal. I'm kind of guessing at that point.
Right.
But now with the touch of a button, if you have a bunch of objects, whether they're photographs or shapes, whatever it happens to be, and you have all of those layers selected, you just hit one button and it will automatically distribute the space between them equally across the canvas that they're on, either horizontally or vertically.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
that is huge. A lot of the work I end up doing in Photoshop is titles and whatnot, or even if you have, like, let's say you've cut out, you're making a poster and you've got cut out a couple of individuals, a couple of people that you've cut out from a photo, It looks like you can distribute them evenly as well. So it's
anything.
Yeah. So that's that really caught my eye. I thought that's something, because I tend to eyeball things or I have little workarounds that I will use that take way longer than that. And because
pulling down rulers and stuff, and
pulling down rulers, creating objects just to line up the spaces myself, and do it visually. And I have I'll call it an obsession for symmetry. And when I put anything together, I like to have those even spaces. And right. So it's like they're talking just to me on this one. So thanks, Adobe.
Yes, I'm glad you mentioned that one, because it was on my list here and I had forgotten to mention it. So some improvements for sure, but it's nothing as drastic as we've seen in previous generations. Maybe they've just covered all the bases. But I would like to see some more revolutionary stuff and not just, better, faster, slightly more powerful.
Revolutionary in what way? What's missing?
Well, you see, that's the problem, I guess. What is missing? I mean, in some of the niche stuff that I do, like focus stacking, I have no control. There's no algorithms. Photoshop just kind of does its magic in the background. Maybe they could improve that. But again, that's still evolutionary. That's not going to drastically change the way that I look at editing. I'm sure that there will be some enhancements in terms of artificial intelligence and deep learning, which Adobe is currently applying to some of their Lightroom stuff in their updates to Lightroom CC. Apparently face detection is getting a lot better, but object detection is as well. For example, if you wanted to search for an image of a boat, all you would have to do is type in boat and it will try to identify every photograph of boats in your catalog.
Mm-hmm.
the example was also, you know, sunsets, and it could figure that out. There is no and or logic there, though. So if you type in boats and sunsets, you will get results for all boats and all sunsets, but not
boats at sunsets
with at the same time. Exactly. So, I mean, maybe that will come. But the fact that they're bringing this in is really interesting. There's been some third party software out for a while. Xire is the name of it. And I've played around with it. It's actually really, really good at artificial intelligence recognition of objects and then keywording things. And if Adobe can just kind of make that a sort of vanilla standard feature that they themselves are constantly updating and improving, then it means I don't have to keyword stuff, which I haven't been doing anyhow because I'm lazy. But now the perfect reason for me never to go into that.
I'm going to guess without knowing, with having never seen your Lightroom library or your workflow, I'm going to guess you're an awful lot like me and you know generally where most things exist.
You know, I can find things in the chaos, or I'll create smart collections. So like if I wanted to find my snowflake photographs, right. Well, I'll create a smart collection, you know, of images taken with my MPE 65 millimeter lens with flash in the winter.
Sure.
And it will give me, say, like a 95% match to all of those particular images.
But if I'm to ask you, okay, you just recently got back from Bulgaria.
Yeah.
When were you're in Bulgaria in what, September?
No, that was August.
August, okay. But year before that, you were there as well. What was the month?
That's right. Probably about the same.
And the year before that?
Maybe a month earlier.
So there you go. So you have a general idea. Now, I have the same kind of thing, like when I'm in Canada, when I'm here, when I'm there, and I mark all these things in my head. And so generally, like you can tell me, hey, you know, I need a shot of this. And I'll think, yeah, of course, we were at Spanish Banks in Vancouver. And that would have been, let's see, my daughter was, she was a year old. So that would have been 2012. And I can find it based on all of that.
Right. And the only thing missing from my new camera that I'm using quite readily, the GX9, is it does not have a GPS component in it. A lot of the images that I had taken with the 1DX, I got the GPS add-on for that. The 1DX Mark II had that built in. Mm-hmm. Lightroom would do reverse geotagging. So if I took any photograph in Bulgaria, it would automatically keyword it based on my location.
Okay.
And that was really, really helpful because, you know, I've been to the Yukon a number of times as well. All I have to do is type in Yukon and all of the images taken within that territory show up.
Now, in that respect, it's nice if you want to do like a collection, like you've been like, for example, I've been to the Goodwood car race a number of times. And if I, you know, my client wants to know, hey, can you send me all the pictures from the years of Goodwood? I do remember where they all are. So I can go find them in, you know, in each individual year. It would be nice to just pump in, okay, great, Goodwood, which I have tagged those. But in general, if you haven't tagged them, you want to pump them in, pump that in. They all pop up and you do a quick export while you go grab coffee. That's where it comes in.
And you know, if I like was photographing an event, one of my colleagues does the Burles Creek Automotive Flea Market in the spring and fall, just north of Barrie here. And so he does, you know, just kind of street photography imagery for the event. But if all of that was geotagged, all you'd have to do is in the maps module in Lightroom, put a little circle over top that event grounds, mm-hmm. and say, show me every photograph ever taken here. And then it would create a new collection for you based on that.
Which, this is what I'm getting at. I find this to be dangerous. Now, I see this popping up in the new Lightroom. They have, like you said, they've enhanced the facial recognition, it looks like. This is dangerous.
Yeah, and it was okay to begin with, but...
Okay.
Why do you think it's dangerous?
It's dangerous, not because of the conspiracy theories like everyone thinks. I'm not worried about that. Most of my friends, they tend to ask me for advice on how to catalog photos because, as I mentioned, they say, oh, I need a photo. Hey, remember when we were at, you know, Stanley Park that time? And I can basically do an instant recall and remember when that was. And not magic. But it's like going to the gym. I kind of train my mind to do that. I'm very particular about how I keep track of my photos and I know where they are. And all of my friends who take photos, which is everybody now, they say, well, you know, hey, how do you, I'm having trouble. My library's bloated. I got pictures everywhere. I don't know what to do with them. I don't know how to back them up. I don't know how to find anything. How do you do it? And I explain it to them.
Well, I want to hear your idea, and I want to see if it's similar to mine, because when I do a shoot, I will usually edit at least one images from that shoot almost immediately. And any edited, finalized, processed images go into a folder called processed images. In there, I separate it based on subject or location. You know, there's a folder for Bulgaria 2018. And in there, I have a master TIFF file that I would use for printing or any further editing, and two resolutions of JPEG, one high and one low. Mm-hmm. So if I need to find another image from that shoot, all I have to do is go and find one image, which is pretty easy for me to locate, and then look at the date, and then go into Lightroom and search for images taken on that date. It's not that hard.
That's very similar to what I do, and I keep things in folders via month and year, and then subfolder month, and that's it. And so now I know, and so I generally in my head, like I keep a sort of an accurate track of my life. And as I guess, as I get older, maybe I'll forget or, and this system will come crashing down, but I like the mental exercise. I also like knowing that I know where everything is. Everything is very neat and tidy. I tend to edit photos almost immediately. I try to, with the occasional exception, When I shoot, I try to get them edited, at least culled, within the first 48 hours.
You're better than I am.
Well, I don't take a million photos of a snowflake, though. So that's, you know, in all fairness to you. But that's how I work. But my friends, it gets away on you very quickly. If you don't stay on top of this, it gets away on you. And so now you don't know where everything is. And so you rely on things like facial recognition to go and find it. Now, it'll probably do a great job, but if the more you have to rely on this, the weaker you get. I hate to say it mentally, but you get mentally weaker on things. And I that's where it gets dangerous to me, is that you let the computer and artificial intelligence handle more of this, and your hard drive gets fuller and fuller. Is it fuller a word? More full. it bogs down, and what do you do again? Oh, you just buy a new hard drive. That's what my friends do.
Well, yeah. I've got a NAS that has some empty bays that I can easily just add more drives and get more space. And I'm not a huge fan of deleting things. I think I did a calculation. This was years ago. But if it took me like 1 second to delete one 20 megabyte file, then the amount of time it would take me to recover like a terabyte of data versus the cost of a terabyte of data, mm-hmm. I'd be working for like $2 an hour.
Okay. But on the flip side, well, this is a rabbit hole. Do you want to go down it? I don't know. On the flip side, but see, to me, everything is nothing. And so if you have just a hard drive full of a million pictures, and in there, you know, you're looking for a needle in a stack of needles sometimes. And so if you can eliminate that noise, you can find those needles. And so my opinion is I edit and forget it, meaning I go through and cull, and out of 10 pictures, I'll pick the one I like the best, that best represents that situation. The other 9 go, and they're deleted immediately. I never look back.
There's nothing wrong with that workflow. I appreciate that you're able to do it. But again, I just kind of pick my favorites and leave the other ones kind of sit where they are. In some cases, that's ended up being of value from an instructor standpoint to show mm-hmm. other variations of a particular scene or images that were stepping stones that led up to the final shot that I really liked. And so I do find value in sometimes going back and digging through those. But 10 photographers, how they handle their data once it's off the camera, and you'll get 20 different responses and fists flying.
True. Now, it did pay off for that guy who ended up going through his archives, and he found a picture of Bill Clinton with Monica Lewinsky in the dress, I believe. The true story, I'm not making a joke. He went back and threw old negatives that he was going to toss, found that image, and it made him a lot of money way back when that scandal was happening.
Imagine. Yeah.
Huh. Yeah. So, I mean, cool. If I eat it on that one, oh well, too bad. But what I'm saying is that I guess if you're asking 10 pro photographers if they rely solely on what Lightroom does with facial recognition, I'll be surprised if any of them answer yes.
Yeah, exactly. One final thing on the Photoshop side of things is they are working on it. It's not out yet. But in 2019, Adobe will have what they call the full Photoshop coming to the iPad. And I've seen some videos of this working, and it looks very, very powerful. It does not look like the full Photoshop. All the icons and stuff are different. The way that you interact is different. But I'm assuming it's much more powerful than any editing software that Adobe currently has on the mobile platforms. You know, this is funny because this is the reason why about 5 years ago, I bought a Microsoft Surface Pro. Mm-hmm. Because it was the same size as an iPad, except it ran the full version of Windows, and I could load up Photoshop and Lightroom in their entirety and take something very, very small, portable, and powerful along with me. And if you haven't looked at the Microsoft Surface products, anybody listening, I mean, go take a look. They're really powerful and full-featured. So this is kind of a moot point to me, but yeah, they're really hammering this mobile platform because that's the trend. That's where most of the youngins are going to be these days.
And what is your workflow with that? How much use do you get out of the full Photoshop on the Surface?
So I use that when I'm traveling, and usually only when I'm traveling to actually edit on the Surface. But it's got a pen input. If I wanted to use it, I do sometimes. But a keyboard and mouse input is what I do on my desktop. And it's the full Photoshop. It might take me a little bit longer to do things simply because it's a smaller display, and I'm used to working on a 32-inch 4K monitor here. Mm-hmm. But it's very capable. It's just not as good in terms of time management. So I only will edit one or two images typically when I'm away and share them in the moment.
And are you confident in, let's say someone needs a print, are you confident in the final product coming out of there going straight to the printer? Or do you
need? Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And I've even had some clients give me work to do while overseas. And I'm sitting in an apartment in Bulgaria doing work for the Royal Canadian Mint for various things. And yeah, they were very happy with the results.
Okay. See, I would imagine it being something that you can get, you know, get your image 90% to where you want it to be, and then go home and do the last 10% polish on big screen.
Yeah, probably. I would say, but if I had to finish things then and there, then I would be confident with the results. That polishing time is what takes the most time, and I probably would give up before I would be satisfied on the desktop environment. Mm-hmm. But hey, Adobe is continuing to make waves. Maybe that's their revolutionary changes, rather than fixing or adding new interesting features to Photoshop, is introducing that powerful tool onto new platforms. So we'll see where this takes us. But I really wanted your opinion, Alan, on the updates to Adobe Premiere and the new announcement of Premiere Rush CC. So they had originally kind of given us a look at what they called Project Rush in June. This looks like it might be my new favorite video editor for the kind of editing that I do. It's not nearly as intense as the stuff that you do, but it's a more streamlined interface. No nonsense, get what you need done and output your final results. What do you think about the improvements and the new product?
So full disclosure, I'm not an expert on Premiere. I've recently come back to it. I do use it. It's my primary editor now. I love it. But I was a Final Cut Pro guy for a long time, since 1999, in fact.
Wow.
And finally, it just died. I never went to Final Cut Pro X. I couldn't stand it. And so once Final Cut Pro 7 could no longer, maybe Final Cut 6 could no longer cut it, I went, someone said, try Adobe Premiere again. Because I hadn't used it since it's one of its early incarnations, like 20 years ago. Hated it.
Right.
Hated it then. Couldn't believe they even bothered putting it out. Wow, is it different. Like, it is a fantastic editor. I love it. And so in terms of the updates, like I said, I don't go that far back, but the one that kind of caught my eye was the new color correction, which is a very, very minor tweak. It adds a few more tweaks into the in the hue and the saturation and little S curves that you can use to really get your footage dialed in.
Right.
Which I mean, I'm not something I'm great at. I know what I want it to look like. I am colorblind, so that does present a bit of a problem. but
I suppose it would.
Well, I'm only red green, so everything else is fine, but it gets kind of mishy mashy in there. But I get the job done eventually, and it just takes a lot longer. But these extra controls look really promising.
Yeah, and the fact that it has right within Premiere now intelligent audio cleanup so that you don't have to send your clip or whatever you're working on over to Adobe Audition and then back again, which again just saves time.
It does. I do. That's one of the things I like, though, is getting really into Adobe Audition, which in the last year is what I've been doing. And I was always, you know, fine at audio mixing and you know, we could get the job done-ish. But working in Audition, you know, and following stuff online and online tutorials and stuff, people on YouTube, I've really diving into doing quality audio. Like, so my audio, even on my videos, has gotten far better in the last few months just because of this.
Oh, so, and it's amazing how much people can tolerate bad video quality so long as the audio is great, but not the other way around.
Oh, for sure. For sure. And so one of the things I really like is the ability to round trip from Premiere to Audition and back, and the results are amazing. But if I can do a lot of that right in Audition, which are in Premiere, which you could before, but it wasn't quite the full feature like they've just announced, it looks like. So this audio cleanup does look fantastic. I'm guessing that's part and parcel to, I haven't had time to look at Rush in depth.
Well, Rush doesn't allow round tripping. It's sort of a no-nonsense version.
So one way.
Yeah. And now you can take a project from Premiere Rush and send it one way to Premiere Pro, but not the other way around. It's kind of like a button-down version of Premiere Pro. It's got probably has a bigger feature set than Premiere Elements does, for sure. It kind of sits in between the two of them. Like, you just need something done quickly, hence Rush, and it'll carry you through that. For the kind of editing stuff that I do, it's usually not even a finished product kind of thing. It's, you know, producing some sample clips that then go to the producer of a documentary, and then they'll be able to give me feedback, you know, based on a sample reel about what footage they still need from me, etc.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I did hear that I can't remember if it was Pro 13 or Rush. I think it would be Pro 13. Is that there's now an auto ducking tool. So if you have dialogue and an audio bed, it'll automatically drop the level on the audio bed when people are talking too, which could be really helpful.
And this is what made me sort of think that Adobe is trying to merge a lot of things, because this existed in Audition.
Yeah.
The ducking. And so for them to be porting a lot of their features over is says to me that they're trying to bring things a lot closer together. But so for guys like me, as I was kind of mentioned earlier, that you know, I'm primarily a video editor who does some, you know, photography and photo editing. It's, you know, so I'm decent at Photoshop, but when you are a jack of all trades, you can be a master of none, is the saying, right?
Yeah.
And so it gets very difficult. Like I don't have the dexterity. I don't have the speed in Photoshop that you do. There's no way. Shortcuts. If you sat us down, you're gonna lap me in 5 minutes. I would think the other way around. Well, especially Final Cut Pro. But as I'm moving over to Premiere, I would think it would be the other way. I think I'm going to be able to move very, very quickly, because that's my area. That's my muscle memory, etc.
Yeah.
The more that they port these over, it helps out guys like me who, sure, I'm, you know, I can get the job done in Audition, but if I can really make it smoke in Premiere on its own, now we're going. And so that's my takeaway from the big announcement, is that they're trying to merge everything together.
And more power to them if they can do it successfully. You know, I guess we are all multimediaographers in some degree. If you're a stills photographer, you'll dabble in video, and vice versa. And, you know, you'll probably have to do some design work at some point. So to have all of the tools mixed together instead of having separate entities, I think is valuable. I mean, I subscribe to the full Adobe suite, and it's a big chunk of change. It's like $70-something Canadian a month. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm glad that I can say that there's value in that. But wouldn't it be great if I just could get away with like the Photoshop and Lightroom bundle and then add on Premiere as like an extra add-on, which I think would cost me $9.99 a month. So that's like $20 US rather than the 50 something. And that would be more palatable because I wouldn't need InDesign. I probably wouldn't need Illustrator.
Right. And that's yep. what I'm looking at as well. I don't imagine they're going to cannibalize their own sales, but that's, I also go for the whole suite because, you know, you need Premiere, Audition and Lightroom and Photoshop. Well, if you're going to buy those,
you're already there, right?
Yeah. So the rest they throw in, which again, I've never even opened InDesign. I didn't know I had InDesign. Never comes up. I'm going to now, as soon as we're done with this, I'm going to go design some stuff, but get my money's worth. But yeah, so if they can do that, if they can get a right way and say, hey, you know what, you don't even need Audition, you can just use Premiere and do most of what you want.
Yeah.
Maybe they're going after a bigger market.
So what kind of projects have you been working on lately, Alan?
Lately, just got back from Canada a couple of weeks ago. I was in Vancouver for a couple of days on a boring corporate job. No offense to the corporation.
Yeah, but I, you know, whether it's corporate headshots or some sort of corporate video, it's not exactly groundbreaking stuff, right?
Yeah, guess who pays the bills, though?
Exactly.
It's them. And then I was down in Seattle. I went and worked with Adam Carolla again. I was with him in the summertime at Goodwood. And then again, he had a show down at the Moore Theater in Seattle and followed by a 3-day fan cruise. So I kind of went and shot the kind of the behind the scenes.
Cool. Yeah, I heard him on a podcast recently talking you up with some nice compliments.
Yeah, that's I guess just after the cruise, but well, one of the photos I took of him a couple of years ago has kind of been, it's become his go-to photo for all marketing and whatnot. So I see it popping up all over the place.
So people get him to like sign it as a 8x10 glossy?
Well, that's a little bit of a, yeah, that was a surprise. We were at the track a couple of years ago, and I just said, you know, I was there to shoot video, but I didn't want to be his part-time video guy. That's not why I took the job. And, you know, I want to expand this and generally my advice to anybody is if you want to work more, you want to work, if you can create jobs for yourself, you're good. Like create opportunity.
Yeah.
And so I basically said, hey, listen, you know, like I'm a still photographer as well. I don't know if you knew that. So why don't we take a couple minutes and go, we'll snap a photo of you. You can, you know, in your racing suit and you can, your fire suit, you can use it for whatever you want. And he was, and as you heard in the story, he was kind of reluctant. He thought, come on, I don't have time for that. And I said, well, you know what? Like it'll take 60 seconds. And so we did it. I went and had his business guy, his manager basically held the flash. Mm-hmm. And we went out, found a little quiet corner, and I snapped three photos and said, okay, we're done. Move on. And he thought, oh no, what a waste of time. And then gets the photo and now he uses it for all of his marketing. And so it's shown up on, like I've seen it being used at some speech he was giving. It was him and Stallone. And so it was a giant poster of Stallone and right next to it, a giant poster of Adam. And it was the photo I took.
That's cool. But I mean, the fact that you were able to do that fast, I think, is what's impressive. Because a lot of people, when you sit down with somebody and you're going to do a photo shoot and you just kind of show up on location, I mean, there's contemplation of angle, there's lighting, there's, you know, so many different factors that would take time.
Right.
But it doesn't mean that you can't just get a run and gun. You already have the idea exactly what you want to shoot. You know your equipment, you know it like the back of your hand. Take a couple of shots, got the shot, let's go. Right?
Well, I have made those mistakes. That's the thing is it's all the mistakes that people talk or all the time intensive things that happen on a photo shoot. I've already done all that, but basically behind the scenes on my own, I don't waste my time in front of the client. And
right.
That does go a long way. So two of the best compliments, aside from, hey, we like your photos, which that's obvious. You want people to like your photos, first of all. If they don't like them, it doesn't matter how fast you are. But if they like your photos, that's great. The next two compliments that I like that really, really hit home with me is one, wow, I can't believe how quick you were able to do that. And that was in this case. And then also shooting the video, the behind-the-scenes documentary footage at his shows or at or on the cruise or whatever it was, the feedback I got was, wow, man, we didn't even see you.
And there you go.
Those are the two things I strive for.
Well, and you know what, like there's a company that that I'm doing some extremely small electrical component photographs for. And these are like chip antennas and things like that. And the fact that it takes me an hour or so to shoot it, focus stack it, clean up everything to make it an absolutely perfect product photo. Well, somebody else, it might take them 2 hours. Or if they spend an hour on it, it's nowhere near as good. The fact that I charge a fair rate for that, I mean, they don't know how much time it takes me to work on one of these images. But the fact that I can do it faster is my benefit and my benefit alone, right?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And they should never ask. Like this is always my argument for, let's say, the NHL. People say, well, I don't like to go to games anymore because you know, it costs too much money. And you know, how come the players need to make so much money? I said, well, it's none of your business how much they make. Either you want to spend $100 on a game or you don't. The end.
Yeah.
And it's the same with clients. It's like, okay, this is worth $100 to me or $1,000 or whatever it is. It doesn't matter. We don't need you to, you know, sit and sweat over it.
Exactly.
I've had clients like that who basically said, well, no, I'm paying for this. I kind of want you to go run, you know, sure, it took you 5 minutes, but I want you to go run in place for 55 minutes. So I don't deal with them.
Yeah. You know, and I came from a job at an advertising agency before I became a professional photographer. And, you know, they might ask me a task that the person that I was replacing, they were on maternity leave, might have taken them 2 hours and it took me 20 minutes.
Right.
Am I going to tell them that it only took me 20 minutes when I'm being paid by the hour and they expect 2 hours of my time being spent on it?
Right. So it's a weird situation to find yourself in. I know I've had those jobs.
Yeah.
And my advice to anybody who has a job like that, quit that job. It's eating your life away, man.
Exactly. Talking about being fast, let's move on to our next story. The world's fastest camera can shoot 10 trillion frames per second. And it's called Teacup. T-Cup. And I'm not sure what the acronym necessarily stands for, but it broke new ground, being able to shoot the temporal focusing of a single femtosecond laser pulse in real time. And they say that the camera captured 25 frames at an interval of 400 femtoseconds, one femtosecond being a quadrillionth of a second, revealing the light pulse's shape, intensity, and angle of inclination. Now, this is from the Université du Québec here in Canada. And that's kind of fun that, you know, Canadians are doing some of this groundbreaking stuff. This is not a camera for aesthetics or, the photographer. This is a camera for science. And I like to bring up these scientific cameras once in a while. It is beating out the previous, I think it was a 1 or a 5 trillionth of a second camera in the past. And so now we are at 10 trillion frames per second. What does this mean to you, Alan?
Well, I mean, I prefer mine to go to 11. 11 trillion. To me, 11 trillion is the cut. This does sound cool, but I can't prove it. I can't prove that it does 11, that 10 millionth of frames a second.
Well, let's just assume that it does. I mean,
why would they lie?
Why would they lie? I mean, for science, you can start exploring the wave particle duality of light in interesting ways that we might not have been able to do before. You can see exactly how a very short pulse of light interacts with an object in real time. Now, this could have some very real impact on material design. Because, you know, let's say a window, a lens, a screen, if you want to control its reflective properties, you can now observe exactly what happens when light hits it and how it reflexes or gets absorbed or goes inside of it at a scale that we were previously unable to explore.
This is step one to inventing an actual suit of invisibility.
Yeah, I guess so. But, you know, it's funny because I don't know if I like reading the comments on these photo blogs. This is on Pedibus. But one guy says jokingly, you know, captured on 65 millimeter 8 perf. And question mark, I am impressed. Followed by Rob Strong, who chimes in and says 65 millimeter stock has 42 frames per meter. At 10 trillion frames per second, the stock would have to move through the camera at 238 billion meters per second, or 795 times the speed of light.
Okay.
Which I thought that was fascinating. I mean, it's just an answer to a joke, but if you compare it to conventional, analog cameras, just the speed that this thing is operating at is just unbelievable.
Considering the fact that they had so much difficulty getting IMAX film to go through the projector and the cameras back in the day, at 24 frames a second without shredding.
Yeah, exactly.
And so they had to do something called a rolling loop, which is what they ended up doing. So at 24 frames a second, that's pretty cool. To doing 795 times the speed of light, that's a lot of info all at once.
Yeah. Not quite sure we're going to hit that on the analog track anytime soon. Not much to really talk about with this particular thing, but the fact that there is a 10 trillion frames per second camera called Teacup, I think, is worth mentioning.
Indeed.
So. Now, I don't know if it was you on the episode where we talked about the potential demise of Meyer Optik Gorlitz. And this company, NetSE, bought the rights to the brand and revitalized it with Kickstarter campaigns and everything. They are no more. There were some rumblings on the wall because in early August they announced that their founder and CEO, Stefan Imes, had gotten into a serious car accident, and the company was having financial difficulties. And okay, well, are they going to come out the other side of this? No. Photoscala reports that the insolvency proceedings have been opened on the remaining assets of the company, and they say that's the final nail in the coffin, because that means that there is no hope. If you backed one of their lens projects on Kickstarter and have not received your lens, you will never receive your lens, nor will you get your money back.
So this is the part I don't really understand. I mean, I understand they're not getting your money back. I understand that that's happening. I don't understand how Kickstarter can be a thing if this is a possibility. Is Kickstarter? I've never been involved in a Kickstarter project, and I feel like I should. There's a few that I wanted to. I just never did it.
So you are basically a passive investor in a company hoping that whatever they're producing comes to market. It might not. You have no guarantee of that. And it's not like you're an investor in the same way that you can claim as a creditor on a bankruptcy filing or something like that. You are just providing the money, hoping that whatever they're creating is going to be created. No promises.
Right. Now, I understand that. But in terms of risk versus reward, this is the part I don't get. Now, if you're an angel investor in this, you're going to take a flyer on something and you say, all right, well, I'm going to give my $100. And if this company flies, well, I'm going to get $1,000. That's how it works. Now, if it fails, like for instance this company does, then I eat it. Well, I can deal with that. But if I'm being asked to invest $100 and the outcome is I'll possibly get a lens that will retail for $150, all of a sudden that risk is not worth the reward.
Right, but the cost difference is, I think, and I can't remember the exact numbers for the Trio Plan, which was one of their first lenses, the Trio Plan 100. They would be retailing it right now for 1,600 euro.
Okay.
But on the Kickstarter campaign, it would have been much less expensive than that. And they have early bird pricing. So if you are one of the first 10 or 20 or 100 people to, it's arbitrary, you get to choose whatever numbers you want, you'll get at a very steep discount, even from what a regular Kickstarter campaign price would be. So sometimes I've seen campaigns that the first person that puts in gets their lens for a dollar.
Okay.
Just as kind of a giveaway, to get the ball rolling. But it's not unheard of to say, okay, for the first batch of 50, we're going to give you an extra $200 off. And so that further incentivizes people to buy in. Now, this also functions not just as crowdfunding to get the money for production, but also as a pre-sale system.
Right.
So the issue was that NetSE launched the TrioPlan 50 Kickstarter campaign before it had fulfilled its rewards to backers for the TrioPlan 100. Now, that means that they are going to be using the funds from this new campaign to pay the people from the previous campaign, or to provide them the product that they've paid for. This is a, you know, robbing Peter to pay Paul kind of Ponzi
scheme. This is a Bernie Madoff situation, yes.
Exactly. And so you can only do that for so long before you run out of funds, because you can't keep that trail going. And I think that that's exactly what has happened here. So I do own a TrioPlan 100, one of their newly created lenses, and I missed the Kickstarter campaign. I paid full price for it. Okay. I think I wasted money on that purchase, but I did get the lens shortly after I had ordered it. This was 2 or 3 years ago, and it's a fun lens. It's a tack sharp lens, top down. It's got the funky soap bubble bokeh stuff, wide open at f/2.8, and it's a fun little trick lens that I take out once in a while when I want to be creative. Mm-hmm. But I can do that with, you know, we talked, it was one of the stories, I think the last time you were on, about the Zenitar 50mm f/2 lens that if you take apart and put some elements inside of it in backwards, mm-hmm. And put it back together, you get some crazy bokeh effects. Well, I bought one and I did that and it works. The in-focus areas are nowhere near as sharp, but it cost me $35. So yeah, I think that their products were drastically overpriced and nobody was buying them after the Kickstarter campaigns. So,
right. That's the rub. Oh, I see. See, my big issue here is what this does to Kickstarter. Or when I say Kickstarter, I mean anything, you crowd, GoFundMe or whatever it is, because they all seem... You know,
Indiegogo's another, yeah.
Exactly. So my thinking, my thought on this always was generally it was meant as a vehicle for pre-sales. Now, I get the crowdfunding part where like, hey, man, we want to build something. We need the money. But generally, the pre-sales should drive that. So yeah. I've always, you know, kind of thought of like, you hear about actors, for example, you hear Zach Braff, a well-established actor with lots of people, you know, knows a lot of contacts in the industry, can probably get a movie made. A couple years ago, he decided to finance his project on one of the Kickstarter, GoFundMe, what have you, and yep. Caught a lot of flack for it. And so people were saying, well, why are you begging for money? Why do you want my money? And I always thought, well, that wasn't really the situation. What he's doing is reaching out to his fans directly, pre-selling the final product, which may be a bust. That's where it ends up. You know, it could be a lousy movie. You don't know. You never know. But
you're just putting your trust in this individual.
Sure. And but what people don't seem to know is that the movie business, for the most part, much of the movie business relies on pre-sales. A lot of the independent movies are pre-sold to foreign territories before the camera rolls, which basically helps fund shooting it. And then what they'll end up doing is selling it, you know, in worldwide markets, recouping the very small front money, the production money, and then whatever they can sell that movie for locally, be it to, in the old days, be Blockbuster Video, but now it might be Netflix, which is, as I say this, Netflix is changing the dynamic entirely in terms of foreign sales. But
right.
The idea being, you do pre-sales and fund it that way, and but you deliver a product. And so I see no issue with that. And so in terms of this lens, I would see, hey, okay, we're going to price this out. It's going to cost us $400 per unit if we build 2,000 units. So that's going to be, we need that money. And once we have that money, we fulfill. We don't, you know, okay, now we're going to expand. So what they've done here is kind of blown it for a lot of other people who have good ideas and could go the Kickstarter route.
Well, I don't think so. I mean, I think some people are, you know, bitten by this and, you know, once bitten, twice shy. But mm-hmm. I think that if a company is 100% transparent in what they're putting forward in terms of production costs and laying it all on the table, showing how all of these different components are machined and exactly what that's going to cost and this and that and everything else, and we need to hit this goal and this is the entire roadmap for everybody to see every number that you want. I mean, you might not put that on the front page, mm-hmm. but if I had that information from somebody doing a Kickstarter campaign, I would believe that they have thought that stuff through to the nines. And yes, there's probably going to be some hiccups. There always are. But if they can at least hit their funding goal and maybe a little bit more, then yeah, I'll give them my dollars.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so hopefully it hasn't poisoned the well for everybody.
Let's hope not. Let's hope not. Speaking of poisoning the well, actually, that's not a good segue at all. The final story was something that kind of came out of left field for me. Found this on a number of websites. One on DP Review says, Kodak digitizing box service breathes life into old media with minimal effort. So what this is you buy a box, and it can be a 3-piece box up to a 40-piece box. There's 10 and 20 in between. And in that box, you can put VHS tapes, film from Super 8, regular 8. I didn't know there was a regular 8. 8mm and 16mm pictures, whether they be slides, negatives, or prints. And audio cassettes, reel-to-reel even. And so you put that stuff in the box. You send it off to Kodak Digitizing Box. And then you get a either a CD, thumb drive, or a digital download link for your data. This has been done before by many companies. You know, Scan Cafe comes to mind. I mean, they're overseas, but
what color is the Scan Cafe box?
It's probably not yellow.
Ooh, okay.
But it's it's interesting to see. You know, the 3-piece box costs $60.
Okay,
that's kind of steep. You know, I mean, it's $20
a VHS photo?
Tape.
60 photos are 3 pieces. Is it 20 photos is 1 piece?
20 photos equals one item. So, you know, you'd be looking at 75 photographs for $60.
Okay.
I don't know. It just the pricing seems a bit odd for me for a bulk service like this. You know, I wish that they could be a little bit more price competitive. Yes, it has the Kodak brand on it, but I was suspicious because I didn't think that Kodak would be doing anything like this. Kodak does exist as a company. They just rolled out Kodak. I think Alaris is the branch that manufactures their film. And I've got 3 rolls of Ektachrome 35mm sitting here on my desk that I plan to shoot in the next little while. So they're still around, but I checked out this Kodak Digitizing Box website, and on their About Us page, it says AMB Media LLC is a brand licensee of Eastman Kodak Company, offering the Kodak Digitizing Box online at kodakdigitizing.com. So it's not actually Kodak. It's like those crazy guys that slapped the Kodak logo on a Bitcoin miner that was you know, seen at CES, or the Kodak One cryptocurrency, which is separate as well. And so many Kodak products, from geez, like eyeglasses to cheap cameras, you might even be able to find an LCD monitor or a portable DVD player with the Kodak brand on it. I know you could with the Polaroid brand for the longest time. So that is not Kodak proper. This company has just licensed the brand, and they're using it to digitize stuff. And I guess good luck to them. But if they're not price competitive, they're not going to move.
So why Kodak? Is it like, I mean, obviously it's the name recognition. And what does Mr. Eastman think about that? I'm sure he's long dead, but what does the family think? I don't understand what's happening here. Can we use Kodak because it's name? It's a known name, but they don't really do anything besides film anymore.
Yeah, well, I guess pretty much every other aspect of the company, as far as I'm aware, and any listener correct me if I'm wrong, there's just licensing deals going around to use the Kodak name on stuff.
Right.
The same was true of Polaroid, as I mentioned, for a very long time. There's even Polaroid branded sunglass shops in Varna, Bulgaria.
Right.
And yes, Polaroid, I think, is now the majority of that brand is owned by the guys that also own the Impossible Project. And so the Polaroid name is now properly associated with instant film again. But I don't think Kodak is going in the right direction with all of this licensing. I think it's just diluting whatever brand value they have left.
So I heard about an interesting article. I didn't read it because who reads? Just read the headlines and move on. But my wife actually read the article because it was in German about how Kodak basically fumbled the ball. It's way back in the day, they had one of the first digital cameras and sat on it because they didn't want to cannibalize their film business.
Yet at the same time, they were able to rack up a ton of early digital camera patents. Mm-hmm. And when they were in, in trouble a little bit later, they started selling off their patents to stay solvent. And that didn't really work out so well for them.
Right, right. And so in this case, I don't know who they're appealing to. I don't know what does the yellow box mean to people under? Well, you're an anomaly. You're kind of an old young guy, but or a young old guy. I'm not sure. No, you're young.
So I think that this is if we were talking about people in retirement,
right?
That maybe they've just retired, they're cleaning up their house, maybe they're downsizing, they find a box of old tapes, film, whatever.
Yeah.
And they say, well, maybe I can get this digitized. Who am I going to go to? Well, Scan Cafe is based in India. You don't know who they are. You're retired. Maybe you don't use the internet that much. But Kodak. Oh, Kodak offers that service. I know Kodak. I will trust them with my digitization. So this is probably geared towards seniors. Mm-hmm. and people downsizing that just discover all of this stuff that they want to see again.
Now, my thought process on this is generally most people that age will have kids who are quite, in their 40s or younger. They would phone them and say, hey, what do I do with this? So I'm wondering if this is a misstep. I had like a few years ago, I got a job scanning like a just ton of old photos from a company that they had just basically in boxes kicking around. So for them, they didn't want to send them in. They didn't want to have to bundle them all up. They didn't trust anybody because they're these old archive photos. They didn't want to mail them anywhere. And so they paid me an awful lot more money than it would have cost at something like, say, Scan Cafe.
Well, and there's that trustworthy factor, yes. Right? So, I mean, Kodak or AMB Media LLC is playing on that that brand to give a little bit of trust to their operation. I think that's smart rather than just going under their own brand. Mm-hmm. But I don't necessarily know if it's going to work. So I wish them luck. It says Kodak says to allow 5 to 6 weeks for everything to be digitized. So it's not a really fast service either, but I don't know. We'll see. I'm hopeful that something like this is a success. Well, there we have it. It exists. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, that is the last story that we have. Do you have a pick of the week, Alan?
I do. I had to go back and make sure I hadn't picked it already. So traditionally I pick something that's old. I don't go with the new stuff, even though this is in Photo Geek Weekly. I'm going to go in the Wayback Machine and say, if you can find one on eBay, Craigslist, whatever, and are into flash photography, especially off-camera flash, buy yourself a Nikon SB26.
An SB26. Now, when, what vintage? What circa is this?
Judging by how mine smells, it's been around for a while.
Okay.
I'm not sure the exact because I own. Basically, what I do is I just kind of every time I'm in town here in Tübingen, I go past the camera store. They have a used section, and the flashes, the Nikon flashes in particular are my favorites for off camera photography, the strobist kind of thing. And they're always on for very, very cheap. And so generally I'll find like an SP24. I have an SP24, I have a 25, I have a 26 and a couple 28s. The 24 and 25 go for about under 20 euros and they're like in brand new shape. They're fantastic. I love them. The SP26 went for a little bit more. I think it was about €40. And I love.
Okay, but still, I mean, that's very inexpensive compared to normal flashes. And of course, I can make the assumption that it's going to be working in manual mode only.
Yeah, it's only going to work in manual. You're going to have to dial all that in, but it is. You can dial it in exactly how you want, from full power down to one 1/64th, and all the third stop increments on the way. The flash head zooms from, I think it's 24 mils out to 85, but here's the reason you want the SP26. Here's where the extra $20 goes to, is it has a built-in optical trigger.
Oh, cool. So it will be fired from another flash.
It will be fired from another flash. So a really hot move to do is like, it's great if you have you have triggers and all that, which I do, but I want to start adding more and more flashes. If you want to shoot with five flashes, well, I only have three receivers. So I can then hardwire one, make a fourth, but then, if you want to add a fifth and sixth flash, all of a sudden you need an easy way to trigger them. Well, I'm not going to buy more triggers. The optical trigger will handle it. and it works like a charm. And even better, like, let's say I'm out shooting, you know, in the street somewhere, and I want to have, like, say, like a nice rim light on somebody. I can have somebody handhold that just above them. I can shoot like an on-camera bounce flash as the key. Let's say I'm going to bounce it, you know, off a building or something and light that person up. And the optical trigger will fire the rim light, all without having to have any other equipment around. It is so fast. It works fantastic. I love them. I have a line on another one. Every time I see one for under probably $50, I will buy it.
Cool.
So maybe that's maybe
the SB26.
Not my pick of the week. I don't want to compete with people. Forget I said that. They're terrible. No, I highly recommend
it. You can't take it back.
Highly.
If you find it in a used bin somewhere or on eBay, take a look. It has Alan's recommendation.
And your pick.
And
of the week.
My pick, something also related to flash photography. And I'm gearing up right now for the snowflake season. I usually start producing those images on December 1st. And we had our first snow here today. So I was looking at, getting fresh batteries and making sure that every bit of equipment that I have works. And I realized Bolt, which is a third-party manufacturer of flash accessories, namely like batteries and things like that, they have something called the P12, which is an add-on battery pack, which I already have. I've got the Canon version, which I foolishly paid the extra money for having the Canon logo on it. It's the same as some of the other Chinese manufacturers. Mm-hmm. But they have the P12 has 12 AA batteries rather than the standard 8.
I see.
So the one that I have now only has 8. And yes, it does keep up with me pretty nice when I'm shooting, although I have to adjust my my frames per second to make sure that I don't get dark frames within that. I can't shoot at the full burst on like the 1DX Mark II at 14 frames per second. It's not going to handle it. But if I can put a few more batteries behind it to charge that capacitor a little bit faster, then I might be able to get away with more frames per second, or at the very least, the shooting sessions outside will last a lot longer. So if you are looking to add an extra battery pack and you are pushing the limits of how much power you can run through your flash and you want to make sure that it lasts long enough for you, if I throw 12 Eneloop Pro batteries inside this Bolt P12, in addition to the 4 inside the flash, and usually there's a custom function for you to choose how it operates, I could be using up to 16 AA batteries to power a single flash, and that makes me happy.
And I'm looking at it right now, it looks fairly compact.
Yeah, it would be something that would fit in your pocket.
Right. Or bolted to the taped to the flash.
Taped to the flash, or I don't know, because I've just ordered it, actually. So this is a pick somewhat unseen, and B&H is shipping it to me right now. But it might have a pass-through to be, you know, mounted onto a tripod or something else, too.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Okay, that sounds cool. Or the next iteration will be wireless.
Wireless batteries, that would be dangerous. I'm not sure if I'd want that.
I think the original George Tesla, Nikolai Tesla, I think that was his move. He was going wireless power.
Yeah, I just don't think we're ready for that yet. I don't mind the cord on this one, but that's my pick of the week, the Bolt P12, and you can find the links to both of our picks of the week. I'll do a quick little eBay search for yours, Alan, and get a link out to people at PhotoGeekWeekly.com. Now, where can people find you?
On Google.
Alan, 2 L's, 2 T's.
Yeah, you'll figure it out. No, you can find me at alanatridge.com or the podcast I do with Adam Schwartz over at twohosers.com.
The Two Hosers Photo Show is one of my favorite podcasts. Listen to you guys all the time.
Oh, I appreciate that. And even when you're on, do you listen to the shows that you're on?
No, I skip.
I understand. I understand. Yeah, you're on, let's just say this week. I'm not sure I'm going to fit that in. Monday, what does that make it? 19, 20, 21, 20, 20, this, the 22nd, Dawn's going to be on the show.
So anybody that wants to hear more of my voice during the next week, then you can head on over to twohosers.com. Perfect. Alan, thanks to you for being on the show again. It's always a blast to have you here. Hope to have you on again. And at this point, I think it's time to get out and shoot.